Welcome to the Photo Booth International Podcast, live from Dallas, Texas. Find us online at photobooth.international.com.
Welcome back to the Photo Booth International podcast. Jasmine Pather here. I have a very special guest today. She's a friend and business mentor for myself and Josh, and her name is Lynn O'Neill. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast today, Lynn.
Oh, listen, Jazz, I am so happy to be with you. This is wonderful. It's a great honor. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, tell us a little bit about, I mean, I obviously know who you are, but for everyone listening, tell everyone a little bit about your history and who you are.
Well, it's long. I went to work when I was 13, and I have been working 63 years. So, because I'm 76, and
young 76.
Oh, well, you are so sweet. Most days I don't feel 76, but I don't know what that was supposed to feel like, you know?
Yeah.
But I started working, and I worked all through high school. I actually took two classes my last 2 years and worked a full 40-hour week, which was great experience, by the way, in sales. And when I got out of college, my undergraduate degree was in sociology, and I actually left Texas and went to California, and it was right on the ends of the Watts riot, and I was trained to be a probation officer. And so I don't know if you've seen the movie Fresh Out of Compton, but the facility where I was a probation officer is literally down the street from Compton.
Oh, wow.
So I had to watch that movie, and it was pretty darn accurate, I'll tell you. So I did probation for a while, and the guy standing next to me one afternoon for an activity was killed by an 8-year-old.
Wow.
And, I decided maybe that it was time for a career change.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually ended up being a flight attendant, and that was where I got my intro to management. And I started out supervising 123 flight attendants. I never supervised anybody. So this was, you can only imagine.
Wow.
They didn't give us any training. They just kind of handed you your list of people and said, here you go. When I left there, I was running the largest base for that airline, had about 1,000 flight attendants, and I had $60 million in catering contracts I was managing, and the Los Angeles commissary. So that was most interesting.
Hmm.
And I left there, and I went with the company that was number 53 on the Fortune 100 list. And the way I got, and it was in an HR job, and I had worked exactly 1 year on an assignment in HR. So mm-hmm. I was really green, but I got this just plum job. And the reason I got it was because of this guy who was a mentor of mine at the airlines. And he said, "Now come work for me." So they sent me to Bartlesville, Oklahoma, beautiful downtown Bartlesville. And I was there a couple of years. That was actually a fabulous learning ground. And then I moved back to California, and I did a regulatory job, and that was for, it was a one-person job for a group of about 35,000 employees.
Wow.
And it was one that was a constant firefight with the government. It was OSHA and affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And boy, it was really interesting. So again, great learning. And then the company, I took a promotion after that. And the company that is now Experian, the mm-hmm. credit reporting company, I actually was the HR director for the part of TRW was the original owner of that service. And so I did that. And then I decided to leave. Actually, what it was, I did not like the man I was working for at all. I mean, not at all. And I didn't think there was much of a future working under him for women. So I left, and with a lot more guts than sense, I started my own consulting business, and that was in 1980. And with just a couple of exceptions, I have done that since then. So I've been consulting for about 40 years, And I do love it. The exceptions for me were after 9/11, my consulting business really tanked. I had a lot of people in the hospitality industry as clients, and there wasn't a lot of hospitality going on then. And so I actually ran an assisted living residence in the city of Carmel, California, which was, again, a pretty plum job. So that was really nice. I also took one brief stint at a nuclear reactor company. It's a part of PG&E. That was a really interesting experience. So I've done that. And then I did a couple of things kind of here and there. If consulting got slow, every now and then I would take a project that would put me in a company, and it kept me really fresh. And one thing I need to add is I came back to Texas in 2006. And even in California, and definitely when I came back here, I always took a first-line job for a while every summer. So I waitressed again, which I hadn't done since I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. I waitressed in one. I sold clothes at Chico's. That actually, I should have just handed them my paycheck every week because I was buying the store out. But I did a lot of different kinds of jobs that I wouldn't normally have to. And I did that because one of the things that that I've always been astounded by is how quickly people in management forget what it's like to be on those bottom rungs. And I remember distinctly the evening I said to myself, I do not ever want to forget this. I think it helps to make people really much improved management if they remember what it was like when you weren't management. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm doing. And I've been consulting, and I recently started up a new firm, a new part of my business that, that I actually am doing the required training for assisted living facilities in the state of Texas. So I kind of have myself in a couple of different worlds at this point. But I think, you know, like so many entrepreneurs, I love startups. So yeah. I like new things. Being bored is the worst possible thing I can imagine.
But that's one thing I can guarantee, that you never do get bored because you have your hands in everything. I mean, talk about such a wide range of work history and experience and wisdom. And so that's why I'm just so thrilled that you agreed to be on our podcast, because you have just so many years of experience in so many different things. And I think that our listeners can really, take away a lot of value from this conversation. So how many years?
I want to tell you, I'm not sure about the wisdom part, just so you know, but the experience is there. And, you know, you taught me several things. You and Josh both taught me right before we got on this call. So I think wisdom is staying learning. I mean, I really do. I think that's staying relevant. I think that's huge. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. So how many years have you been a consultant now? You said since
99. Well, overall, it's 40 years. I'll start my 41st year on August 1st. So it's coming right up. And, you know, I did have those little bitty spurts. Mm-hmm. Where I wasn't doing as much consulting, but I've never let go of the consulting practice, because if I had to name one thing that has my heart, clearly that's it. So,
yeah, and I think that comes so natural to you in the last, is it almost 4 years now that we've known you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. You know, Josh and you met through the Goldman Sachs program here in Dallas that Josh was so fortunate to have been a part of. And I feel like that was a very integral part of what became the foundation of our business, because it opened up the doors to other like-minded entrepreneurs and people such as yourself that, you know, have been able to encourage us and, share some of that consulting with us, and it's really helped. So Being that you've been in this type of industry for so long, for over 40 years consulting, what are some of the top mistakes? I'm sure you've probably seen trends, even though it's been, you know, for 40 years now, I'm sure some of those same patterns come up every time, depending on the company. So what would you say are some of the top mistakes that you've seen in business?
Well, there are a couple that come to mind immediately. And by the way, I think we were lucky to have Josh as well. I actually had him three times because I had him in the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Business Program as a class member. And then I had him as a class member in the SBA's Emerging Leaders. And then I had him again in the Kauffman Program through the Hispanic Chamber that's called Scale Up. So look out, you're on my list. So you're next to go through that cycle, which would be great. But the things that I see over and over, and honestly, I see them in my own life too, because as an entrepreneur, I think it's in our drinking water. But the biggest thing for me is people forget to learn their financials. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean, lots of people think, oh, that means, you know, I've got to learn every item on this balance sheet and all that. Really don't. I think the biggest thing is to learn what three or four line items on a P&L and a balance sheet incurs on your cash flow. Those are the three reports that seem to be stressed over and over everywhere that I've read and everything I've ever learned. But it is not understanding everything. It's not understanding all that. It's understanding the trends. You use that word trends too, and that's really the key. It is if you know what are the major markers of whether or not you're going to be profitable and whether or not you can continue to offer your business, then that's great. And I'll tell you, one of the things that going through a lot of those classes that we were talking about, one of the things that people say over and over to me is, I just surprised the heck out of my CPA because I asked questions about which, and my CPA said, well, you've never asked me that. And one of the trends we see, by the way, related to that, is about half of each one of those three classes, about half the people switch CPAs somewhere in that process.
Oh, I bet.
Because what you find is you've got a CPA, you formed a relationship, they're used to how you work, you're used to them telling you what to do. Mm-hmm. And the issue is when you come in and start asking those annoying questions about what you should change, and what's holding your profit down and that kind of thing. So that is one. But even before that, and this sounds crazy, but people don't have a purpose when they start. And as trite as that sounds, because people have written a million books on that, I still run into people all the time when I say, well, why are you really doing this? Mm-hmm. Because just to make money will not a happy entrepreneur make. Mm-hmm. I think that we are contribution-based. And so if we are doing something and there's really no true contribution to it, most of us are not going to be happy. It is rarer than rare for me to run into an entrepreneur who feels good with that. And I'll tell you a funny story. When I first started consulting, I don't know what prompted me to even think I could ever do this. But my mission when I started was to change the way the world manages. And I haven't quite made that yet, but I'm still working on it. But that has been my mission for years and years. And I've sort of sidetracked a couple of times, but I always come back to that. Mm-hmm. And part of that was because I had some really elegant managers with and for whom I worked, and I had some that were just awful. And the latter group, I don't think they leave a bigger impression, but boy, they are definitely unforgettable. And I always think, you know, we spend more time at work and with the people who work with and for us, and we work with and for, which could include our customers, of course, that we spend more time with them than with anybody else in our lives. So more than family, more than friends, if they are not the people that you really get joy from being around, Not worth it. It's just not worth it. So I find a lot of people who don't have that purpose, they can give me what their goals are for the next year. You know, we want our profitability to be 20% over last year or something like that. This year, it's we all want to survive the coronavirus. But you know, they'll say that. But if you ask them, what's your overall mission? What's the change you're going to be in the world? What are you leaving this world better for when you go wherever we go? And I find many of them are stuck for an answer. And I honestly think, and I know with my consulting clients, that's one of the first things I ever ask them. And if people cannot come up with something, that's okay, because we can get them there. But if they really dig in and say, you know, that's really not important to me, I just don't take them on as clients, because there's no use in me frustrating me and them all at the same time, because we're on two different paths. So the financials and the purpose, I think there's a lot of talk today about sustainability. Mm-hmm. And I do, you know, I do think that's huge, because you don't want to be kind of a, what they used to call in music, a one-hit wonder.
Yeah.
You don't want to be a one-hit wonder. By the same token, if you know what your purpose is and you understand your financials, the chances are for you being sustainable are really good. So those are the things that I see that people don't do. Mm-hmm. I do find that once they get on that track, that people get very excited about the purpose. Getting people excited about financials is a little bit harder.
Yes.
But I think that's fear-based. I mean, I think most people are scared of those, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I can totally relate to that. As far as the financial portion that you're talking about, we switched CPAs a few years into our photo booth rental business, and come to find out, I mean, I think Josh has told you the story. We had to redo our books for like 3 years.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't until Josh kind of started to get a good grasp on what financials involved and what he needed to look out for that he realized, wow, I need to get out of this CPA firm fast, and I need to get a different CPA. And so once that happened, we feel like we're a lot more in control of, you know, how things are being kept inside of QuickBooks, and we're a lot more knowledgeable as to, you know, what our profit and loss statement looks like, balance sheet, all of that. And I myself, you know, coming from being a pharmacy tech and getting into the entrepreneurial world, for me, it was all like a whole new vocabulary, right? And I had no idea what any of these things were. And granted, there's still some times where I'm just like, what is that? And I asked the CPA, can you explain some more? Because I realized that the more questions we ask, the better, right? And the more that we dig a little deeper, the more we know and the more we feel comfortable with the process, and the more we can, you know, you have to be able to inspect what you expect, right? And it's those things that you don't know. The things you don't know,
yeah,
are the ones that get you. And so that's what happened with our previous CPA. And so I can 100% relate to that. And as far as, you know, where we're at now, I think that I'm still learning about financials. I think that there's still so much to learn, but that's definitely, I think, a common thread there is.
But the two of you, the way that I can tell that you've mastered it, and I don't think we ever quit asking questions. You know, financials are less change oriented than a lot of things, but they still do change. I mean, because what your data is telling you about what to do will change. And the way that I can tell that you guys have done that is you have pivoted two or three times in your business really strongly. And you don't do that well unless you know your financials, and you guys have really aced it. Mm-hmm. And so that for me, and I'll tell you something, it is not a perfect thing. I mean, there's none of us who haven't made a left or a right turn and thought, you know, in retrospect, wonder why I did that. But that's how you can tell that people know what their financials are. other than that, people just kind of splay out and they're going after 5 or 10 things, which is, in my opinion, is never a good strategy. Mm-hmm. And I heard this interesting statement yesterday. And you know how when you hear one of those, it's kind of like, huh? So it's kind of like, expect what you inspect. I actually really love that. Wow. The one that I heard yesterday was a good strategy is knowing what not to do. And I never thought of it that way, because you always think about a strategy says, okay, here's my direction. This is where I want to go. You know, that's actually a really interesting way to look at it, because it also is avoiding those things that will take us off purpose or mission, or will take us down a less than profitable track. Mm-hmm. Which of course, when you have employees, which you guys do, the minute that you get into that, you've got a whole bunch of other people who are relying on you to make really great decisions. That to me, that's one of the hardest burdens around small business ownership, by the way, is doing that. And I have this great sign in my office that says something about, are these your people? And is this your love or something like that? And it says, if not, why are you here? I look at that every day and I think, yeah, that's really good. Because if you don't care about those people who work for you, they will pick up on that immediately.
100%. Yeah. And that goes for, like you said earlier, if a new entrepreneur or businesses in general don't know what their mission is, what they're hoping to, how they're hoping to impact this world, then yeah, it makes it very difficult. It's like you don't really have any guidance and you don't really know what you're doing. And then you end up feeling really miserable. And it comes across to your employees, to your spouse, to your customers. And it's just it's definitely not, you can pick up on it, and people don't want to do business with people that are obviously in just to make a buck or so and not in it for a long term. So I think that's very obvious when someone is in it for the wrong reasons.
Oh, I think so too. Well, you know, I wrote my very first book was called Managing High Maintenance Employees. Mm-hmm. And the number one reason for employees to be high maintenance, which is, it's a soft dollar cost on that balance sheet, because there's no line item for having to spend extra time with employees, but it is a cost, most definitely. And the number one reason, and you just nailed it, the number one reason that people are high maintenance is they don't understand the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you and I have ever talked about this, but when I go to a new client, if they have a receptionist, I always ask the receptionist, So what's the mission around here? And I have found over these 40 years that if they can tell me exactly what that company is about, and it may have changed from the last, but whatever the mission is, the current mission, invariably when I look at their financials, they are really healthy. And if they say like, oh, I think it's up posted in the break room, or you probably have to ask HR about that or something like that, invariably their financials reflect that. Isn't that interesting? So there is an energy follows purpose.
Yes.
So, and we want energized employees. So to get them energized, it behooves us to say, you know, and this is where we're going, and to ask, and how do you all feel about that?
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time doing that with a team, and this one guy, he was really irreverent, and I loved him dearly. And he said, what are you smoking? And I said, I beg your pardon? And he said, that's the worst mission statement I've ever heard. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And I said, what would you do? And he just laid out this most gorgeous mission statement that you've ever. And I said, yeah, I think we'll go with that one. I mean, and everybody around me, yeah, you know, we really like that. And this team, they were so sweet. They would have gone with anything that got put out there. They were just the most wonderful team. But it was dumb, and what I came up with was not smart. And I hate to admit that, but that's the truth. Mm-hmm. And here was this guy who's just was brave enough, courageous enough to say, you know, boss, that is really dumb. That is just where I am.
That doesn't align with what I know that we stand for.
Yeah. And I was so grateful to him. I just, wow, It was wonderful. And we promoted him very shortly thereafter.
I was going to say, I mean, it takes a lot of courage, like you said, to be able to speak up, but it also takes an even bigger leader and someone to be open, right? And to encourage opinions to be spoken. That's one thing that I think is very important as a leader. When you're able to project onto your team that, hey, I'm not perfect. I don't have all the answers. And so I would love your input. And a lot of times we're surprised with some of the ideas that some of our employees have to share with us, you know, because they just offer such a different perspective and they're all unique and they have their strengths where we're weak. And so I love that. Being open to constructive criticism or new ideas, I think that's such a huge key in being a great leader.
Well, I think so too. And the reason we promoted him, we kind of made a job for him, a great job, I might add. But we probably wouldn't have done it had he not done that with the mission. And the reason for promoting him was to show everybody else that it paid to bring, because if we had just had that one meeting and done, I think for people who were hesitant to speak out, we wouldn't have heard as much from them. But we promoted him. He got this giant, beautiful office of course, he was working his head off too. There was that, but he loved it and he was wonderful at it. And we really wanted to reward not only the actual contribution, but the courage, that part of it. And I think sometimes we really do forget that. So, yeah.
What a great way to commend his contribution to the business in that way. That's amazing. So
he went on to run his own company, by the way. He's made millions.
Oh, really? Do you still keep in touch with him?
Yep. And he's still in California, and he is he does a great job. So
awesome. Now, yesterday we spoke, and you told me that you're featured on DCEO magazine. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, nobody's more surprised. I actually love that magazine, and I read two or three. I read the Dallas Business Journal, and I read the Fort Worth Business Press and Fort Worth Magazine. But the DCEO is my favorite. And part of it is that they will tackle topics that a lot of the other publications kind of skirt around. And I'll give you an example. Brandon Call was their managing editor for quite a while, and he is gay. And he wrote, and they had a cover story about gay execs and gay employees. And I thought that we were talking about courage. That takes tremendous courage. No matter where you come down on that issue, you know, I'm not saying yay or nay. All I'm saying is that they tackle that. And the issue that I just got this mention in is one, and they have three phenomenal African-American women who are in some positions that are going to reshape Dallas and maybe all of North Texas, maybe the state, maybe the world. I mean, that'd be wonderful. But I was so pleased. So one of them is on the cover. One of these wonderful women is on the cover. The other two have just super articles as well. It's just really, it's talking about how the face of Dallas is changing. And, you know, everybody talks about, oh, we've got to do diversity and inclusion, but it's become a word that people just roll off their tongues, and it doesn't necessarily mean. So I'll tell you my favorite line about this. Somebody said this to me, and I said, oh, my God, I love this. And it is, diversity is being asked to come to the party, and inclusion is being asked to dance while you're there.
I love that.
Isn't that gorgeous? Beautiful. You know, because people, you know, they'll talk about, well, we've got this percentage of African Americans and this percentage of Hispanic and this percentage of Asian and this percentage of American Indians. You can do it. As a triracial person, which I am, I really, really love when people are really into the fact, you know, these are people and they're talented, and let's just give them a shot. Let's level that playing field and go for that. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. I think that, talk about a mission. You know, that is one. So I'm always pleased. So I got this mention, and actually it's kind of funny because it's talking about women getting financing in Dallas. And when they call me, I think they were disappointed because I'm usually relatively upbeat. But on that topic, I can just sink into the trenches because I think women have a much harder time with financing. It's mm-hmm. It's been that way for decades, actually, maybe centuries, looking at how long it took us to get the vote. Mm-hmm. My news for them wasn't necessarily cheery. And I was actually heartened when I read the final article because Valerie Freeman, who is just known everywhere in Texas, and she's a remarkable female executive, remarkable human. And she talked about when she's been in business right around 30 years, somewhere in there, I've forgotten exactly. But she talked about having to take her husband in order to get her first business loan. And so she's in that article too. But the DCEO, you know, run, don't walk to get a subscription, because it tells you, they really pick people who you wouldn't always read about, mm-hmm. but they're always people who are making a difference. And it comes every 2 months and I race down and get my copy and get a glass of wine and sit and read for half the night. I mean, it's wonderful. So
I love that. No, after you told me that, I went online and I got my copy. Yeah. So yeah, if you guys just Google DCEO, and I believe it's a June and July issue, it was mm-hmm. $15 to get it shipped to my house. So I highly recommend that. And that way you can check out Lynn's feature in the magazine.
That's other good stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited. That's the first that I'm hearing of that magazine. But I mean, just hearing you rave about it, I'm sure that I'm just going to probably dig right into it too. So
I think you'll love it. And on July, I forget if it's the 15th or 30th, I think it's 15th, they have their diversity and inclusion conference. And it is phenomenal. So I'll be there. Come with me. We're doing it virtually, but we can go together virtually.
Yeah, we'll do that together. Yeah, that sounds great. Now, any tips for someone that's looking to start a business during this time?
Yes. The first thing that I would do is do really good market research. And I'll tell you the easiest way. So this is the tip. If you go into Google and set up a Google alert, they're free. And so whatever kind, let's say that you, because you worked in the pharmacy industry, let's say that you're looking for how many pharmacies are there in my zip code, or changes that pharmacies are making. You can put that information in a Google alert. And every time somebody either opens a new pharmacy or they're having a big sale, every time that hits the press, you're going to get an email that they'll tell you. And the reason, so that's competitive research. So people think, oh my goodness, you know, I've got to go and get all the books out and figure. And I think that's good to do, because if you're going to start a business and you're going to enter a field without understanding who else is in there and without understanding who does it well and who, if anyone, doesn't, if you go in without that, I'll tell you, that's like saying, please let me fail. Mm-hmm. So market research to me is huge. I know that the really great advice is never to do it starting with your credit cards. But I have to be honest and say that's how almost all of us start. You know, we run our credit cards up to the max. So being undercapitalized is kind of epic in the entrepreneurial world, if you can avoid that. The other thing I would say, and this may not endear me to a lot of folks, and actually you and Josh are examples of the other way, but for most people, they should not hire their relatives, for most.
Agreed.
If you make it work, I know three or four, and that includes the two of you, I know three or four people who make that work, and I know that you make it look easier than it is, because just having two people who are together constantly, that's a challenge in and of itself. But people hire relatives or friends. And I will tell you that as a 40-year consultant, almost invariably I get called in to help them get those people to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is, hiring is not a science anyway. And yet you start your retention program when you decide you're going to have an opening, you're going to hire. That's when you start your retention planning. And all this, and by the way, someday we have to do another call on onboarding, because onboarding to me is the key to keeping your employees and keeping them productive. But it's, so it's one step in the hiring process. But having friends and family,
it's tough. Yeah, it's tough.
It is, and it's a lot of times it's tough for all the right reasons. We don't want to hurt anybody, mm-hmm. you know. But that doesn't necessarily help. Not hurting somebody doesn't necessarily help your bottom line, and it doesn't get you to your mission.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, those things. So if you can get capitalized, that'd be good. If you understand the market that you're entering, and if you tell all your relatives that they can buy stock when you go public instead of hiring them, it's a much yeah. better answer. Much better answer.
So. 1,000% agree with you on that one, on all of them. But more importantly, don't. I know it seems easy, and you're kind of in a rut. You think, okay, like just hire them; they're going to help me out. But yeah, things get pretty complicated pretty quickly. So yeah, I would recommend. Yeah, don't do it. Just try your luck with the people that you don't necessarily have that type of relationship with. It makes it a lot easier to, you know, give constructive criticism or reprimand, and they're not going to take it personal because they know that
Absolutely.
You're the boss. So, yeah.
And they will follow. You want people who will follow your leadership. Certainly, if you're going down the wrong track, like the example I cited, then yeah. you want people to say that to you. But yeah. you want people who are truly involved. They have bought into the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And they're ready to do what it takes to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, yeah, that's my guess. I've said that to people and they said, well, that is terrible. And I said, it's true.
So. I can vouch. So to add, like, that made me think of something. So one thing that Josh and I actually started to do whenever we are looking to hire is we actually read our mission statement out loud to them. And then, you know, we try to like gauge, you know, like people, you can kind of see their facial expression. So that has helped us kind of identify, wow, does it invigorate them and does it excite them, or do they not really care and are they just here for a paycheck? And so that's been a really great thing that we've implemented relatively new, like in the last year or so. So that would be my little tip to end this podcast episode off, is if you have identified your mission statement and you are looking to hire, go ahead, you know, and tell them what you stand for and just kind of gauge their reaction based off of that. And I think that will be a great indicator on whether
I'm going to take that one. I've never heard that. And that is phenomenal. Just phenomenal.
Wonderful.
Goodness. Oh, we have to do this more often.
Yes. We'll have to do another episode on onboarding. I think that's a very important topic.
It is.
That's something that I think that I can definitely learn from you, because it's a challenge. Employee turnover can be high sometimes if you don't really know what you're doing. And we've made a lot of mistakes along the way. And I'm sure that you have a lot to share when it comes to that topic. So
I want to tell you, Jess, that there is no one I have ever met who has never made a bad hire.
Mm-hmm.
Never met anybody who can say that. But I love your idea about the mission statement. I don't know if you read, but there's a great book called The Ideal Team Player. It's the same guy. It's Pat Lencioni. It's the same guy who wrote The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. And they do a version of what you said, in that they came down to 3 characteristics, and I've forgotten them all, but one was if you're hungry, and the other one was if you were humble, and then there was a third one. And they said they didn't care about the rest of what somebody brought. If they didn't bring those things, they didn't want them on their team. And so, which is really what you're doing by reading. Oh, goodness, I love that mission statement. Pat Lencioni could learn from you, my dear. That'd be great.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again, Lynn. Thank you so much for being on our podcast. Where can people find you?
O'Neill.enterprises is my website. And if you're in the assisted living, I have ALM oneill-ct.com. That's another website. But oneill.enterprises is probably the place to start. And I will put in a commercial that if anybody's looking for a speaker, I do a lot of speaking and I love to do that. So
wonderful. Well, there you have it, guys. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thank you again, Lynn. And if you want to hear more about how what tips and tricks Lynn has for onboarding, be sure to comment or send us a message. And until next time, bye, guys.
Bye.